I am so glad to be here this morning as we are continuing in this series. And I think you'd agree, especially if you have personally experienced it, there are a few things more disturbing when you see somebody with power or influence or authority and they end up leveraging it for their own benefit to the neglect or even the abuse of or the expense of the people that they're responsible for, the people that have chosen to follow them. And at the same time, there are a few things more inspiring than a leader that has some sort of power or influence or authority who ultimately says no to himself or no to herself to say yes to something for the sake of the people that they are either leading or people that are following them, people they're responsible for, or people that have chosen to follow them. So the reality is that for all of us, we never really know which lever we would pull or which button we would push until somebody actually gives us the position, until somebody actually puts us in that position of authority. We don't really know which way we would go until we actually have authority. We like to armchair quarterback or daydream or imagine what we would do, but until we're actually in the moment, we don't really know until we have the authority, or in David's case, until we get the crown. But we're going to see today, the lesson that we're going to see today applies to every single one of us, because it's only a matter of time before we find ourselves in a position of power or influence or authority over someone. We find ourselves in a position where we hold the cards, we're bigger, we're stronger, we have more authority. Maybe it's in our family, some sort of relationship. Maybe it's in the workplace or the classroom, in some situation. And if you're just joining us, you're kind of coming into the end of the movie. This is a series, David. It was birthed out of a church out of Atlanta, and we've been following the life of David and the lessons that he learned, and we've been learning along the way. And if you've missed any of this series, you can go to newlifewichita.com, and you can listen, watch, or download. Now, David, when he was a young teen, there's a day he's out working, and Samuel the prophet, who was the authority, main authority other than the king at the time in ancient Israel, he showed up at David's home, and he says to David's father, Jesse, hey, I'm here on a mission, but as we discover, it would be a secret mission, and the reason it was a secret is because Samuel's mission was to anoint the next king of Israel. Now, the problem with that is, as we've learned, is there was already a king of Israel, so he needed to keep this a secret. But he shows up, and he doesn't tell Jesse or anybody why he's there. He just says, Jesse, I've come here to do a special sacrifice. I want you to invite all of your family for this special sacrifice. And the idea, Samuel thought, was that he'll invite everybody in, and then when he sees the one in this family that God has to be the next king of Israel, he'll just know it. He'll get the nod from God and just know this is the guy. So Jesse invites all the family for this special sacrifice. They all gather together, and Samuel's just scanning the crowd. He's trying to figure out who's going to be the next king, and the text tells us that when they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab, which was Jesse's oldest son. It was his firstborn. He was a big dude. He was good looking. And in this culture, it just made sense that you would go with the firstborn, especially in a situation like this. And he thought, look at this big, good looking firstborn guy. Surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord. He thought, this is easy. This is the firstborn. We don't even have to have a sacrifice. Quick and easy. But the Lord said to Samuel, however he said it, do not consider his appearance, which is very, very difficult to do. Because when you and I meet someone, the first thing that we notice about somebody is not their IQ. You know, it is not their manners. The first thing you notice is the way a person looks. I mean, if you're single or you're doing the online dating thing, you're not that concerned if they like cats or play the sax or like long walks on the beach, at least not till you see a profile picture, right? Then you might be interested. And all of us, and even in ancient times, ascribe value and sometimes even authority and influence to people that look good, right? And God says to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. Why? And this is very, very important for us. The Lord does not look at the things that people look at. People look at the outward appearance, which is true. We all look at the outward appearance. But the Lord looks at the heart. In other words, it's what's in a man that makes a man. So ladies, don't be fooled by his outward appearance. What's in a woman that makes a woman? So men, Never mind, you're hopeless. So six sons later, still no king, right? All the sons are there, and they're starting the sacrifice, and Samuel's looking around, and, you know, and he's like, I haven't gotten this kind of the nod from God, and maybe something's missing. And so you imagine this awkward moment. He goes to Jesse. Jesse, is this all your sons? Is this all the family? Are these all the sons you have? You know, I ask you, invite the whole family. Is this everybody? And Jesse looks around, scans the group. They're like, oh, no, the youngest is missing. You know, he's out tending sheep. And Samuel said, send for him right now. We will not sit down until he arrives. And so they send for him. This little shepherd boy, David, arrives. At this time, he's about 13 or 14 years old. And he shows up. And however God said it, then the Lord said to Samuel, rise and anoint him. He is the one. And Samuel walks to this middle school age David. He pours oil on his head. He gives him a blessing. He packs up his stuff, and he just leaves. And the family's standing there. What just happened? Because there is no indicator at all that Samuel told them why he was there or what he anointed David to do. But from the time that David was a middle school age boy, he knew that God had something special for him, that God had set him aside for something. And then less than 2 years later is when he kills Goliath. He becomes an overnight sensation. And then for the next 7 years, David is in the good graces of the kingdom. And David is in the good graces of the king. In fact, King Saul marries off one of his daughters to David. David becomes best friends with one of Saul's sons, Jonathan, who was to be the next king. And for 7 years, things are great. And then last week, as we saw, Saul is very insecure about himself. He feels threatened. He feels jealous. He tries to kill David. He puts a bounty on his head. And David becomes a fugitive from the law for 8 years. So he's anointed by Samuel. He's in these good graces. And then suddenly, he's on the run. He's hiding with his band of merry men. He's trying not to side with the Philistines. But at the same time, he's trying to stay away from King Saul and all those that support the king, all the while knowing God has chosen me for something special. And if you read through this incredible detailed narrative, and there's so much of it that I skip and I don't include, but if you pay attention to this, all the while David is learning some very important lessons. And perhaps the most important lesson that David learns in the wilderness years was this lesson. And this is where David's story intersects with ours. Because there are times when God can seem indifferent, unaware, or absent in our lives. And a couple weeks ago, in the life of David, we see what he does because he decides to take matters into his own hands. Because for all of us, there will be these times for whatever reason, God seems indifferent, unaware, or absent. And we take matters into our own hands, and so often we make things more complicated and more difficult. But David has already gone this path, and he's learned that in the big picture, this is not about me. It's bigger than me. It's bigger than I know, and it must be God's will, God's way, and God's time. It's God's will, God's way, and God's time. And on two occasions, as some of you know, David has an opportunity to take matters, to take control, to take matters into his own hands and kill Saul and just end all of this craziness. One of them is a famous occasion where David's hiding in a cave. King Saul and his army, they are passing by, and David is with his men. They're hiding deep into this cave, just waiting for it to pass by. And as soon as it passed by, they pass by, they're going to go the other direction. Many of you may know this story. So David and his men are hiding in this cave where their eyes have adjusted, and Saul's eyes have not. And why that matters is because Saul is going by with his army, and it's one of the only references that I know of in the Bible. Like suddenly a guy's got to go to the bathroom. So stop, pit stop, everybody's stopping. Saul gets off his donkey. He goes inside the mouth of the cave. He's just in far enough. He's out of sight of everybody else. And again, he's in there. His eyes have not adjusted. David and his army, their eyes are adjusted. They're there. And all of David's guys look at him. He's in the most vulnerable position possible. And they all look at David, and they say, this is your moment. This is your moment. It's like, are you kidding me? God just says, he has delivered your enemy into your hands. Then the men said to David, this is the day that the Lord spoke of when he said to you, because David had told them, just hang in there with me, just stick with me. Things are tough, but God has something special for me. Don't know exactly what it is, but just stay with me. This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to do with as you wish. And David almost falls for it. He creeps up, He's about to kill King Saul and then walk out of the cave victorious. And he knows that he will walk out. And if the king is dead, everybody will immediately declare him king. They will capitulate. And as David is about to kill King Saul, he realizes, no, I've already done this wrong once. I'm not doing it wrong again. I've already learned this lesson the hard way. I'm not going to take matters into my own hands. It must be God's will, God's way, and God's time. And instead, he just simply cuts off a piece of the king's robe and then creeps back to his men. Saul finishes up his business. He goes, he gets on his donkey, starts to leave, gets away a little ways, and then David appears in the mouth of the cave and yells out. He calls out to the king, and immediately he has the attention of Saul and his entire army. He holds something up and says, "Look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but I did not kill you." And everybody in Saul's army knows that in that moment that David could have killed the king, and he chose not to. May the Lord judge between you and me. I'm not going to be the judge. May the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. And at that moment, everybody in both armies, they know I have every right and I have the power to take your life, but I did not do it. Then a few months later, Saul and his army, they're in a desert called Ziph. It's this wide open plain with rolling hills. There are virtually no trees, so it's just out in the open. And David had sent spies out to track Saul's progress and know where he was so that they could avoid him. And the report comes back that they're camped out in this open area. So David decides that he just can't resist. So he gets a group of guys and they go up on this hillside to just go and check things out and watch the army and see what Saul's up to. And King Saul himself was positioned right in the middle of the army. So he is surrounded by about 3,000 of his men. And he's laying on the ground. His spear is in the ground by his head because that's how they slept. And as the sun went down and things got dark and everybody goes to sleep, David could not resist. And he turns to his friend Abishai and says, "I've got a really, really bad idea. Want to join me?" And Abishai says, "When do we get started?" David said to David and Abishai, they went down into Saul's army at night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with a spear stuck in the ground near his head. So they sneak, just the two of them, down into the middle of this army. And when I read this, I love this guy. This is like, I want a friend like this. So, of course, I would have been the one initiating. So the one responsible for protecting the king's bodyguard, Abner and the soldiers were lying around the king. So these two have crept past the guards. They've crept past all of the soldiers. And now they're standing there. And then Abishai whispers into David's ear, "Today God has delivered your enemies into your hands. We missed this opportunity once. We need to not miss it again. Now is the time. God wills it." How else can you explain the fact that we have been able to creep in here unnoticed, and now you are standing here by the head of the sleeping king? Abishai says, "David, I know you've got all these convictions and you've got this whole thing, like you can't kill the king, but you know what? God didn't tell me I couldn't kill the king. So, you know, just let me pin him to the ground. With one thrust of my spear, I won't strike him twice." Like, "David, I know you're committed to not killing him personally, so just let me kill him. That way your conscience can be clear and I won't even mangle his body." And imagine it, David. Imagine it. You stand right here over him. I will thrust this spear into his heart. His eyes will open wide, and the last thing he will see in this life is your face. And this army will wake up, and they will declare you king. Honey, you need to read the Bible. So David whispers to Abishai, don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? And see, this is such a big deal. In other words, God is the one that put this individual in place. It wasn't me. And until God removes him, I won't lay hand on him. It's got to be God's will, God's way, and God's time. However, David is not above a little fun, which is why I like him. He says, "Take Saul's spear, and I'll take his water jug." And they creep out of the camp, they go up on a hillside, and after they've got a little far enough away, David starts hollering out. He just can't resist. "Abner! Abner!" And again, Abner's the chief of King Saul's bodyguard. It's like, "Abner, missing anything?" Everybody recognizes David's voice. They look over. He's silhouetted on the hill, and he's holding up a spear and what looks like to be a water jug, and they turn and look, and the king's spear and the king's water jug are missing. And David shouts out, "You are a poor excuse for a bodyguard. I came in the middle of the night, and I took the king's spear, which meant I could have killed the king. Abner, you and your men deserve to die for being such a poor excuse of a bodyguard." And then David and his men just melt into the desert. Well, eventually, and again, I'm skipping a lot, King Saul and his son Jonathan are killed by the Philistines in battle. And the text tells us that when King Saul and Jonathan, the two men that stood in the way of David becoming king, then instead of throwing a party, David mourns for them. He actually mourns their deaths. Israel had 12 tribes. The tribe of Judah, which is the tribe that David is from, the tribe of Judah declares him king. But for the other 11 tribes, King Saul had one of his other sons, Ish-bosheth. He declares himself king. And so you've got the 11 tribes. They fall under Ish-bosheth. And then David, he takes over Judah. And for 7 more long years, there's just this conflict between David and the house of King Saul. And throughout this conflict, people are continually saying to David, because David clearly had the influence, he clearly had the power, he clearly had the strategic mindset. They kept saying, "Claim what is yours, claim what is yours." And over again, David would say, "No, it's got to be God's will, God's way, in God's time. I will not lay my hand on the Lord's anointed. And if Ish-bosheth has been declared king by those 10 or 11 tribes, then he is king. I just need to stay out of his way until God removes him." 7 years this goes on. Then finally, 2 brothers sneak into Ish-bosheth's house while he's taking a nap, and they murder him in his sleep. And they think they've done this great thing because now they have removed the only barrier between David and now being king over the entire nation of Israel. So they cut off Ish-bosheth's head, and they take it to David to give him the good news to receive a reward. And the text tells us they brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron, and they said to the king, "Here is the head of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, your enemy, who tried to kill you." Now, about beheadings in the Old Testament is full of beheadings. In fact, in ancient times, beheadings were quite common, and the reason why is because they did not have galaxies and iPhones. All right, nobody had a camera, okay? So the only way that you could prove somebody is actually dead was to show proof, and they could lug the body around, but who wants to do that? So they just take the head off and show it off, and here it is. So they throw the head in a bag. They get to King David. They're expecting they're going to get a reward because they've personally removed the last obstacle to David becoming king of the entire nation. They're so excited. And David answered the brothers, "As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble." The Lord who has delivered me. The Lord who did not need nor ask for your help. When someone told me, because I had killed them, "Saul is dead," and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and I put him to death. I skipped that part of the story. That was the reward I gave him for his news. Now suddenly these brothers are not so happy. How much more when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own bed. And the people around David would have thought, what do you mean an innocent man? I mean, this was an individual that claimed to be the leader of the kingdom that ultimately you were to be king over. But in David's mind, again, it was God's will, God's way, and God's time. So David gave an order to his men, and they killed them. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in Abner's tomb in Hebron, which was a sign of honor. And after Ish-bosheth's death, finally, the 11 tribes did in fact finally declare David to be king of the entire nation. After being a fugitive for 8 years, and after being at war for 7 more with the house of Saul, all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel in their military campaigns. David, we all know who had the influence, who had the power, and who deserves to be king. And we know the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become the ruler.'" So everybody knew that David was destined to become king. And they just couldn't understand why he wouldn't just grab it, why he wouldn't just take it, because he had opportunity after opportunity. And when all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron to crown him, to hand him the power, it is in this moment that David shows his true greatness. It's in this moment that David applies everything that he has learned on the run and in the wilderness and shows his extraordinary maturity that he would not have had at 15 or 20 or, as we saw, at 22. But the difficult lessons that he learned during this time in running from King Saul, in this moment, he would apply them and he would show his true greatness. So they're about to hand him the power. He holds all the cards. His word is law. He already has the influence. He's the most powerful person in the nation, in the room. And even without the crown, the text tells us that King David made a covenant. He made a covenant with them at Hebron. Now, in our context, we think of a covenant as like a contract. A covenant in this context is, I will do this if you will do this, and if you will do this, then I will do this. It was making an agreement where David made promises to the people. And what we miss is this was completely unnecessary. Again, he's the king. He does not need to do this. His word is law. So why in the world, after being mistreated for all of these years, specifically by these individuals that would not go ahead and accept him as king, and these group of elders who did not support him when he was on the run, I mean, he could have exacted vengeance in this moment, what any other king would have done. And every single one of these elders, he could have exacted vengeance, except for those that were part of the tribe of Judah that accepted him as king. But instead, he made a covenant. And the question is, why? And the last three words of this text explain it. And this is the point of the story. When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, he made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. So in this moment, what he is communicating, what he is making quite clear, is David recognizes publicly that he would be a king under authority. In this moment, he submitted himself to God's law, which meant as a leader, he was submitting himself to the people that he would actually rule. This is his way of saying, I am a king, but I am not the king. Because as we said in the first part of this series, with all of David's ups and downs, with all of his flaws, he never confused himself with the king of Israel. And they made him king. They anointed him king over Israel. And David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel for 40 years. And we're going to pick up the story right there next week. We'll take it to the end so you don't want to miss next week. But here's the important thing to not miss. I don't know how many of you remember, for those of you that most of you are not 15. So when you're 15, like 30 was like 1 foot in the grave, right? It's just like, that seems so old. So like from 15 to 30, so for 15 years, 15 difficult years, David did not receive what he had promised. He went through all these trials, all these struggles, had to be on the run. There was a bounty on his head. All of this, David waited 15 difficult years for God to give him what God had promised him. David waited 15 difficult years for God to give him what he promised. And during that time, during these difficulties, God was preparing him for something bigger. And he took these extraordinary lessons, and they were the lessons that would make him a good king and a right king. And he learned leadership is always stewardship. And that even kings are accountable. And if you are a leader in any situation, you're a boss, you're an aspiring leader, you know, we read the story like this, and again, there's so much that I've skipped, and you just think, man, this is such an inspiring story. You need to read the story. There's so much I left out. But it's really not enough for us to just be inspired. If you're a Christian, the reason that this community that we call New Life exists is to help each of us, each of you, outside of these walls, 7 days a week, to be in your workplace, in your relationships, in your classrooms, in your neighborhoods, fully devoted followers of Jesus. And so if you're a Christian, this kind of great is actually a requirement. It's required. It's an inspiring story. In fact, you don't even have to be a believer or believe a Christian. You still think, you know, what an incredible story, and there's so much to this. What an inspiring leader. And you know, it's just inspiring whenever a leader says no to themselves and says yes to the people that they're leading. That's always inspiring. But if you're a Jesus follower, if you're Christian, it's not enough to just be inspired. It's required, this kind of greatness. Because 1,000 years later, just 20 miles north of where this took place, in the city of Jerusalem, Jesus would model this kind of greatness, but with a twist. In an unusual way. John, who was an eyewitness of all these things, who lived to be an old man, who gave us some of the greatest literature that has become part of the New Testament. Here's what he wrote about this incredible moment when Jesus modeled what David modeled, but Jesus did it with a twist. It was just before the Passover festival where the Jewish people would gather together to celebrate God rescuing Israel out of Egyptian slavery and captivity. Big, big celebration for Jewish people then, as it is for many Jewish people now. And Jesus and his disciples are gathered in this special room. We call it the upper room, where they would meet together for this final meal together, the Passover meal. They're finishing up the Passover meal. And John, who was there and then later would interview out all this detail from Jesus later, said that somehow Jesus knew in this moment that the hour had come for him to leave this world and to go to the Father. Jesus somehow knew that in just a few hours, he would be arrested by those he came to save. He would be crucified by those he came to save. And this is so fascinating. Like David, he's been anointed by God, but not recognized. Like David, during this meal, he would inaugurate a new covenant. But it wasn't a new covenant with the 12 tribes of Israel. Instead, this was a new covenant, which, again, a new covenant, why we call the second half of our Bible the New Testament. He would initiate a new covenant between God and all of mankind, but not through the blood of an animal, through his own blood. And John says somehow in this moment, he recognized that the end had come and that this is a very, very special moment. And here's what John says. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So in this moment, Jesus had the power without the crown. He had the authority without the title. He's holding all the cards. He recognizes somehow that in this moment that God has put everything under his authority, and we don't fully understand it. But what we do know is Jesus knew at that moment. We get a little taste of it a little bit later on where they go to defend Jesus and he stops them and he says, "Do you not think at once I could call 10 legions of angels?" I mean, there was something that had happened where he was given this authority. And so John tells us, so he got up. Now the question is, what do you do when suddenly you're the most powerful, influential person in the room? What do you do when you hold all the power? What do you do when you're surrounded by the betrayer, the coward, and those that are going to abandon you in your moment of deepest need? Jesus said, and John says, Jesus got up from the meal. He took off his outer clothing and he wrapped a towel around his waist. And the disciples couldn't believe it. I mean, there's just so much emotion in this moment. There's a murder, and Peter's going to say, "No, you are not about to do what it looks like you're about to do. Like, we have seen what you can do with those hands. You are our rabbi. You are our teacher. You are our Lord. You will not wash my feet." And Jesus just ignores them. And he is persistent. And he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. And then he put his rabbi robe back on to show that, yes, he indeed is one with authority. He is one with power. And I don't think anybody said a word because nobody knew what to say. Because he had just preached the most powerful message to these men, that what he meant by what he did was so obvious he didn't need to say anything, but he did say something. He said, "Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set an example that you should do as I have done for you. If I'm not too good to wash your feet, you're not too good to wash one another's feet." So he says to them, he says to me, and he says to you, that if you're a Jesus follower, in those moments when you feel you have authority, you're big stuff, you're finally important now, you've got a title, you've got a nameplate, you've got a name on the door, whatever it is, somehow somebody's given you the keys, you have authority, you have a corner office, whatever it is, it's an opportunity in that moment, you look for more feet to wash. Because perhaps the greatest indicator of our maturity is what we do when we have authority and power and influence. Perhaps the thing that says more about us than anything else is when it dawns on us that we're the most powerful person in the room, the locker room, the classroom, the office, the conference room, the boardroom, any room. And let's be honest, in some capacity, we have all been handed the keys in some relationship or another. Because some of you have a title. For some of you, you've got the crown. Some of you, you're a boyfriend, you're a girlfriend, you're a father, you're a mother, you're a husband, you're a wife, you're a manager, you're a supervisor, you're an owner. Maybe you're a big brother, a big sister, you're president of what it is, you're a board member, you're a scheduler, you're an administrator, or administrative assistant. Somehow you have authority. And I would even go so far as to say, even if it's just that moment where suddenly you have the power, because in that moment it comes to light, you were right and the other person was wrong. And now you're in the position to just rub their face into it or bring the hammer down or whatever it is. Whatever the situation, we would do well to embrace the greatness. Embrace the greatness that David learned the hard way and that Jesus modeled for us. When you're the most powerful person in the room, in the moment, in that relationship, that you leverage your power, that power, for the benefit of the other person, for the other people in the room. And that's what David learned in the desert. It's what Jesus modeled for us. And if you're a Christian, it's required of us. It's required of us. It's required of me. Because after all, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So imagine if all of us, with any influence, led that way. Imagine if each of us, all of us, lived that way. And what struck me fresh as I was preparing for this morning is that you're surrounded by men and women that have embraced this. For example, what many of you may not know is that there's a leadership team that serves this community. It's made up of 20, 30, 40, and even 50-something. Married and single, business owner, a business leader, aircraft engineers, a software developer, a news anchor, a young woman who recently stepped into a role where she's influencing the next generation to help end sex trafficking in Wichita. And these men and women have busy, demanding schedules personally and professionally in their lives. They sacrifice most Thursdays throughout the month. And the whole reason that they gather, the weightiness of the meetings, the burden of the heart of these individuals is you. And this community. And the larger community. And how can we best serve this community? Because we believe that there's more to this life than this life. And that Jesus came that we might have life and have it in the full. And how do we best help everyone become and be fully devoted followers of Jesus? And they carry the burden that over 200,000 in this city identify as no religious affiliation. 200,000, more than 200,000, that haven't come yet to know that Jesus did in fact live, did die for them, did come back to life, and that his resurrection validates everything else. And this morning, you were greeted by students and pilots and medical professionals and educational professionals and people with positions and prestige in their various industry. Many of them set aside their preferred fashion choice and wear a shirt with a big hello on the front. And next week, we're going to share communion together. And it's going to be set up by an extraordinary woman with an advanced degree who's a scientist and teaches biology at a private college, who recently, at the request of the majority of the graduating students, has been asked to be the keynote speaker at the commencement, because though she is known as one of the toughest professors, she's also one of the most loved, because her students know they matter to her and that she would do anything to help them succeed. She does all that. Next week, she will be setting up little plastic cups with little pieces of bread-like substance. Why? Why does she do that? Why do these individuals do this? Because they serve a Lord who, at the moment when he had all the power and all the authority, wrapped a towel around his waist and just washed feet. History tells us that that kind of selflessness changed the world once. And our vision is to be a catalyst. We don't just gather, that we scatter, as Jerry likes to say, my friend, gather and scatter, that we want to be a catalyst that sends change makers like Jesus into every environment. When it dawns on you that in whatever moment that you've got the power, you've got the strength, you've got the authority, you've got the influence, that you use that for the benefit of the other people in the room, that's what your Savior did for you. Let's pray. Father, I'm so thankful for the people in my life that they had a position of power, authority, and they used it for my benefit. I thank you for Jesus who led the way in this. And I pray for each one of us, and especially the young men and women in this room, that they're going to continue to grow and thrive in their careers, and the day will come when they're going to have even greater influence and greater authority, and that God, that you would drive this lesson into their heart, and that they would use that power for the benefit of others. The people would just be dying to work for them, or be dying to be in their class, or just to be around them, to work with them, because they have the best interest of mind of those around them. And Father, I pray that you truly would give us the strength and the ability to every moment, every decision, every segue, to pause and truly trust your way in your time. I pray all of this in the name of Jesus.